to the Make an Impact podcast presented by the American Association of Suicidology. I'm Chris Cosentino, and today we're joined by Dr. Jonathan Singer. Dr. Singer is a professor at Loyola University in Chicago's School of Social Work, as well as the founder and host of the Social Work podcast. He is a best-selling author of two editions of Suicide in Schools, who holds both a master's and PhD in social work and has been the recipient of numerous awards for his research into several topics, such as family-based interventions for suicidal and cyberbullied youth, service access and service utilization, school-based responses to youth suicide, and the use of technology in education and clinical practice. Dr. Singer is also a former president of the American Association of Suicidology, and it is my absolute pleasure to welcome him to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Chris. It's great to be here.
We have so much to discuss, but I want to rewind the tape a little bit here and learn more about what inspired you to make an impact in the field of suicidology.
So when I was in high school, I was in the play Ordinary People, which is about a kid whose brother dies in a boating accident and he attempts suicide. And this play, which was a book and also an Academy Award-winning movie, it really unpacks a lot of issues around family, around schools, peers. And fast forward to when I graduate with my MSW, I got a job working in a mobile crisis unit doing suicide risk assessments for children and adolescents and working with their families and going into schools and doing all that sort of stuff. So I was fascinated by the topic, and then I got professional training and I realized that this was an area that I cared deeply, deeply about.
Now, one of the many things that drew me to working at AAS was that it was an organization with more than 55 years of providing trainings, research, and accreditation. But the organization lost its way over the past few years, and I saw it as an incredible opportunity to join the team that is dedicated to getting it back on track. Can you take us through your time as president and how in 2024 we can take AAS to new heights?
So, I had been attending the American Association of Suicidology annual conference since 2006. I found the leadership to be very warm and approachable. They invited me to participate in things such as the creation of the Recognizing and Responding to Suicide Risk program, the school certification program. I met several collaborators that I worked with on research at the conference. And then in 2014, I was tweeting out about attending the conference, and I was contacted by April Foreman, who had recently become involved with the conferences and suicide prevention. And she invited me to participate in something that they were calling SPSM, Suicide Prevention Social Media. Over the next couple of years, we had this amazing community build up online. And one of the things that we talked about was how the American Association of Suicidology, for all of the great things that it did, wasn't really using technology very well. It wasn't thinking about suicide prevention and technology. And so over a matter of a couple of years, several of us from this community, Bart Andrews, April Foreman, Tony Wood, Anne Marie Matulis, like a bunch of us got on the board. And originally the focus was on technology, but then, you know, as one does, when we got onto the board, we started governing the organization and making recommendations. And we did some, I think, great things. We came up with policy recommendations. We worked on the 988 transition. We consulted with Netflix about 13 Reasons Why. We published media reporting guidelines. Our work with other organizations around firearm suicide prevention, around working with groups like Big Brothers Big Sisters, all that stuff, right? Or sorry, Boys and Girls Club, not Big Brothers Big Sisters. So working with Boys and Girls Clubs, we did a lot of really good work. And then when the organization collapsed into the burning heap that it collapsed into, I know that I and several other people walked away out of a sense of sort of caring for ourselves and also not wanting to damage what really was this beautiful integration of a professional community, but also a personal community. And so I think one of the places that AAS needs to go is a rebuilding trust with the community of folks who are interested in suicide prevention, building lives worth living, building a world worth living in. And ideally, after rebuilding this trust or embarking on this process of trust, to once again have a conference that feels like it is the place where everybody wants to show up. Because I know that AAS is much more than the conference, but for most people, the conference was AAS. And the Suicide Research Symposium has taken over to do some great things with research, online research conference. The Youth Suicide Research Consortium also does great things with connecting folks. There are other organizations out there that have stepped into the void, but nothing has been able to replace the AAS conference as a place where folks who've lost loved ones to suicide, who've been suicidal, who are working on crisis lines, who are clinicians, who are researchers, all of these folks can gather in one place and address this issue, which is not owned by any one group. So that's where I think AAS needs to go.
No, that's great. And right now we're in the works of getting AAS 24 going. We have a great agenda in the works, and we're really excited to get to Las Vegas in May. Your dedication to youth is greatly appreciated, and it would be important for us to discuss what the signs and symptoms of youth suicide look like.
So youth suicide, as with suicide in any age group, can vary in terms of why people might be suicidal. But to the best of our understanding, kids who are suicidal, there's a group of kids who kind of have constant suicidal ideation. Right? They wake up, and they think about suicide, and it kind of hangs out in their brain. It's just something that's kind of part of who they are. They might not have the desire to end their life. They might not be planning on it, but that's the, you know, that's sort of one group. You have a group of kids who something happens, or a series of things happen over a period of time. And again, with adolescence in particular, time is much more intense and short, right? So if somebody's, like, for example, in a relationship for 3 months, that can feel like an eternity. Or if they're getting harassed at school or online, and that goes on for a week, again, that can feel like an eternity. And so you get kids who will sort of distance themselves from important social groups. They might deactivate social media accounts. They're making statements about how nobody cares if they live or they die. They might be agitated or irritable or angry or upset in ways that are kind of out of character or out of context for them. They talk about having difficulty sleeping. For some kids, there might be an increase in substance use or specific types of substances. For other kids, there's an increase in self-harming behaviors that might have started out as non-suicidal but have transitioned into suicidal self-harm. So there are lots of different things that we can look out for when we think about youth suicide. I think one of the important things to note is that there's a myth that children can't really be suicidal. And I know from a practitioner standpoint and the very little research that there is, that you absolutely have kids under the age of 10 that have thoughts of suicide, that make suicide attempts, and that die by suicide. And for those kids, you know, research by Jeff Bridge and Ariel Scheftal and folks have suggested that the demographics and some of the characteristics of those kids differ. And so you're more likely to have Black or African-American kids, kids with diagnoses of ADHD, and kids that are experiencing abuse or neglect at home as kind of primary concerns for the child age group.
What tips do you have for parents or guardians who are looking to have a conversation about suicide with a child?
Well, I think one of the things is that parents have to remember that asking the question, are you having thoughts of suicide, isn't going to make their kid suicidal. It's also important for parents to be able to talk about the things that surround suicide, right? Experiences of isolation or neglect or being rejected by peers or, you know, a bad breakup or other things, including things that have to do with a parent-child relationship. And the work that I did with Guy Diamond and Suzanne Levy on attachment-based family therapy, I think was really influential in my thinking. And one of the things that they talk about in ABFT is having parents use what we might think of as very basic skills, which are being able to identify and label emotions, right? So it seems like you're really, really upset right now. And being open to listening without interruption to what's going on with the kid. So saying, it sounds like you're really upset right now. I'm going to validate you. It makes total sense that you're upset by that, which is different than agreeing with them. And then saying, tell me more, right? Opening up the space for the kid to talk without interruption, without criticism, without a retort, right? Like, you don't want to be the parent that's like, oh, so what's going on? You seem really upset. The kid says something and they're like, wait, that's what you're upset about? Oh my God, that's nothing. Like, you have no idea. Like, when I was a kid, like, we didn't even have the internet. Are you kidding me? You know, like, we had to wait weeks to figure out what that song was that we listened to in the car, right? We had to get out before the DJ could say what it was. It was miserable. Like, you have everything at your fingertips. Are you kidding me with this? Like, you don't want to do that.
And one area of your work is to focus on family-based interventions for suicidal and cyberbullied youth. Walk us through what those interventions look like and where or when it is appropriate to have one.
Well, as I was just mentioning, attachment-based family therapy for suicidal and depressed youth that was developed by Guy Diamond, Gary Diamond, and Suzanne Levy is one of the empirically supported interventions for reducing suicidal ideation. There's also evidence to suggest that what we think of as kind of Rogerian or supportive therapy also is effective in reducing suicidal ideation. So one of the things to think about when you are considering family therapy for a kid who's suicidal is that a good family therapist, whether they're trained in ABFT or not, is going to understand what's happening in the family as a family issue. And so parents who go in for family therapy, they would do well to think about this not as I'm the parent, I'm going to go in, and then a therapist is going to support me to talk about what's wrong with my kid, but rather that the therapist is going to say, what's happening in the family, right? Parents, you need to do something different as well. You need to think about this differently as well. And then a good family therapist will provide the support for everybody in the family and the rationale for why you should do this together. And again, it doesn't have to be ABFT, could be any family therapy. But I think one of the great things about family therapy for suicidal youth is that it turns it from being the kid as the problem to the family as the solution.
I'm curious to know, what are some school-based responses to youth suicide, and how do we become more proactive in preventing a youth suicide?
So schools can do a bunch of things. One, they can provide upstream prevention, which includes things, you know, early on, elementary school, which reinforces the idea that schools are a place where kids can feel supported, kids can find sort of support in individual adults, right? They can see adults as people that they can turn to, that they can be successful with their peers, that they can learn kind of basic social and emotional processing and explanation skills. They can also do things like screen for suicide risk, right? So you have programs like Signs of Suicide that include an education and awareness component and a screening component. And it also requires schools to be able to coordinate with community organizations to do referral, which is really important because if you have a kid that says, yes, I've been having thoughts of killing myself lately, do a follow-up assessment. It seems like this kid would benefit from connection to a psychotherapist. You want to be able to connect them with somebody who has availability, right? Which is not an easy thing to do. So doing the advanced work to find out who's available, who's in the community, who can provide culturally relevant care, really important. Another thing that schools can do is that they can provide what we call postvention, which is that after a kid dies by suicide, which luckily doesn't happen all that often, but when it does, it sends ripple effects through a community, right? It's devastating to peers and to the family and to the community, to provide grief and loss counseling, to monitor kids who might already have been at risk for suicide to find out if those kids following their peers' suicide death are at increased risk. And I want to say that there are lots of things that schools can do, but I think it's really important for schools and communities to not think about schools as the only place or a separate place. So for example, if you have a school that's in a community where the kids are really heavily involved in faith communities or sports, that the school and those communities, right, the faith communities, the external sports communities, whatever it is, that they coordinate to say, ah, kids are showing up at this place after school. Let's make sure there's suicide prevention here. Let's make sure that there are people who are trained to talk in these spaces. Sherry Moloch is a psychologist who's done amazing work around faith communities and suicide prevention. And she talks about how it's important for faith leaders to address suicide from the pulpit, not just once a year in September, right? Suicide Prevention Month, but that it is an ongoing part of their conversation so that people in the congregation know that this is a person that I can talk to. This is a community where I can share something that might be shameful or embarrassing or confusing.
Now, access to helplines has become a topic of conversation because of the volume of calls that crisis centers receive. How do we improve access to these services?
So I think there are a couple things we can do to address access. I think that one of them is the efforts that crisis lines have been doing. Like, for example, Crisis Text Line offers services in multiple languages. You have 988 Suicide and Crisis Line that you know, has not just voice but chat and text. In different languages, there is an option for veterans, right, and folks who have worn the uniform to get services specifically from folks who know what that experience is like. I think that there are some kind of very practical issues around wait times, which my understanding is they've decreased significantly over the last couple of years since the rollout. But also making sure that we are providing enough resources to support all of the local crisis lines that 988 refers out to, kind of switchboard style, that those folks are getting the training and the support they need to provide helpful services. You know, the horror stories are legendary, and they get a lot of press. And I think they're a minority of the phone calls, but each one of those was somebody who was in a crisis, right? however they define it. And they did not get what they need. And I think that the goal should be that everybody gets what they need. The other thing is that as a community of folks involved in suicide prevention, we have to remember that 988 is not the only game. So you have Trans Lifeline, which is not part of 988 because Trans Lifeline does not support active rescue, right? And so this is a really important thing for folks to know about, that if you're wanting services for trans, non-binary folks, and you are concerned about police involvement, don't call 988. Call the Trans Lifeline, right? Because they don't do active rescue. And so I think all of these things are really important for us as suicide prevention folks to be aware of, support, and let folks know about.
In the past 10 years, what do you think have been the most noticeable changes in mental health resources, factoring in the COVID-19 pandemic, the rise in social media, and other social issues that have come up in the past decade?
I think in the last decade, one of the biggest and most important shifts in suicide prevention is that people have been able to acknowledge that race has always been a defining variable in suicide prevention. But that the race that has been the default is white. And that ignoring that was perpetuating narratives and systems that made it difficult for the suicide prevention community to be seen as a community where everyone could get their needs met. Now, I'm not saying we're there, right? But if we want a world where people feel like their lives are worth living, we can't have a society that says that some lives are worth more than others. And if we have a field, right, of suicidology, where we're not actively pushing back on funding mechanisms that prioritize suicide for some groups over others, or that we're ignoring the special needs because of some sort of status, then we're not going to be doing what we need to do. Now, let me say, that the numerically the group that dies by suicide the most is white men. So I don't want anybody listening to this to confuse my comments as saying that what we need to do is to ignore white people in suicide prevention. What I'm saying is that we need to acknowledge the ways in which these structures and these systems have ignored really important issues related to race in suicide prevention. And so, as well as gender, as well as sexual orientation, other statuses that are important to acknowledge. And that if we do a better job of that and we address some of these structural issues, we're going to be able to reduce suicide deaths.
Finally, what advice do you have for parents who have a child struggling with suicidal ideation?
Well, I would say that for parents who have a kid struggling with suicidal ideation, it's important to know that it's not only up to you. That hopefully there are at least one or two other parents out there that you can talk to about what's going on. They might not be in your neighborhood. They could be folks that you meet online. That there are professionals whose job it is to be able to talk about these issues and to support you. And what I will say is that this is going to be, especially the service delivery system, it's going to be frustrating. It's going to be fraught with all sorts of barriers. But what we know about a suicidal crisis, especially for kids, is they tend to be short-term. So you get kids who talk about wanting to die, and for the most part, in 1 to 3 weeks, the suicidal crisis is gone. Now, it doesn't mean that the underlying issues are gone. They probably are not. But the specific suicidal crisis is gone. And that's a good thing, because then it gives time and space to work on some of those other issues that might be going on. And these could be anything from like what's happening in school to issues around sexual or gender identity, issues around community, all sorts of things, right? And so being able to address those after the suicidal crisis is really important. It's an opportunity, a window of opportunity to really address something that might otherwise not have risen to the surface.
Dr. Jonathan Singer, thank you for joining us today and for all that you continue to do to make an impact.
Thanks so much, Chris. It's an honor and a pleasure to be talking with you today.